This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, which means it's time for the Week in Review.
This was an act of violence born out of hate that inflicted terror on an entire community. So I would call it a hate crime. I would call it terrorism. It's both.
That was FBI Special Agent Ron Hopper on Wednesday speaking about Sunday's mass shooting in Orlando, where a gunman killed 49 people, injured many more at The Pulse, a popular gay nightclub. Angel Colon, a Framingham native, was shot in the hand and hip but survived.
I can hear the shotguns closer, and I look over and he shoots the girl next to me. And I'm just there laying down. I'm thinking, I'm next. I'm dead.
The shooting heightened so many American challenges: homegrown terrorism, anti-LGBT discrimination, the debate over gun control. President Obama weighed in multiple times this week, yesterday from Orlando.
As has been true too many times before, I held and hugged grieving family members and parents, and they asked, why does this keep happening?
Well, we're going to explore many of the implications of this weekend's awful events. Joining us to do so in the studio are Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, welcome back to the studio.
Hi, Meghna.
Also with us is John Carroll, professor at BU's College of Communication and a senior analyst for WBUR. Hi, John.
Hi, Meghna.
So there's so much to discuss, and I just want to start by letting you guys sort of share with me, how has this week been for you? What have been your major thoughts, Renee?
You know, it's really been overwhelming. From the first reports that started to come in, and as the numbers kept increasing and increasing, it seemed absolutely impossible, even though, as the president said, we've been down this route before. It also hit me personally because, you know, I'm gay, and I lived in Florida, and I know what the club scene is like down there, and the sense of community you have in the clubs, and the idea of that being violated, and people losing their lives in the place where they went to feel a sense of unity, it's been really, really hard to deal with.
John?
I think the hardest thing to deal with for me is the replay aspect of this. I mean, this is just the same scenario, the same script playing out over and over and over again. And you try to be optimistic. You try to think what good can come out of this because of all the horror that came out of it. And I don't know what good can come out of it because I'm seeing the same dynamic playing out over and over again. And you know, from newspaper editorials to President Obama to Hillary Clinton to the victims and their families, everything feels depressingly the same. And I just feel like I don't know what makes this stop at this point. That was the headline of the Globe editorial, mm-hmm. Make it stop. Mm-hmm. I don't know what makes it stop because it doesn't feel like there's anything. If these things don't make it stop, I don't know what does.
Okay. Well, where to go next? Okay. You know what? I'm going to focus on, first of all, on the LGBT aspect of this because I feel like there were so many issues, as we said earlier, that were laid bare by this. But the one that that Renee and I, as you said, seemed to hit so many people the hardest was the fact that this particular community was targeted. And it's so funny because earlier in the week we spoke with a young man who had told us that after the last year's Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage, he started feeling for the first time a sense of safety and security, and then the weekend's shooting and violence had torn that away from him. And I was just wondering if you could share with us more thoughts about that. Like does the entire community or many members of the community feel unsafe again?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It happened last week, last Saturday. It was Gay Pride in Boston that weekend.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful weekend. And I didn't go. And I remember saying to someone, I said, well, I don't feel like I need it as much as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm out to my family and my friends and at work, so I don't really need that sort of thing. So there was this kind of sense that, well, you know, things aren't perfect, but we're in pretty good shape. And then this blast of hatred hits you Sunday morning when you wake up. And it has changed things. You know, it's, I think in one way, it's awakened the community in a very different way because it says, yeah, you know, it isn't all great. You know, there's a lot of challenges out there and there's a lot of people that still hate you deeply. Yes, it's great that you have same-sex marriage. Yes, it's great that you have other protections. But the bottom line is that there are still people out there whose hatred runs deep enough that they will walk into your club and murder you.
Hmm. John, your thoughts?
One of the interesting things was how many politicians, Republicans in particular, tried to neutralize the LGBT aspect of this, an element of this. I saw a tweet from former U.S. Senator Scott Brown, who said, well, these were Americans. Let's not focus on any other status. These were Americans who were attacked. The Florida Attorney General, who got into a really sort of awkward back and forth with CNN's Anderson Cooper, was talking about them as citizens of Florida. And I think that idea of trying to push that aside, that element of it aside, was something that really did a disservice to the community itself and also to everyone else in terms of trying to somehow sort of neuter this whole issue and make it less than it was by widening it out, making it sort of less heinous than it actually was. And I thought that was a real sour note. I thought that was really a bad chord to hit.
But I thought that was very reminiscent of what happened a year ago today, when the people at the Bible study at the church in Charleston, South Carolina, mm-hmm. were murdered. Mm-hmm. And the next day it was like, this isn't about race. This is nothing to do with race, even though the suspect was an avowed white supremacist. So the whole idea that, oh, it's not about this thing, it's about now they're Americans, yeah, it lessens it. You know, it kind of takes away the moment to say this happened to these people because of who they are.
Right.
You know, and I think that, you know, especially on the right, it was very easy to suddenly say, oh, but they're Americans and this is about happened to all of us. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it happened to all of these people, all of these gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transsexual people and their supporters and friends. It wasn't just this sort of general spray. He went there with the intention of killing these people.
Well, and also he went on Latino night at the Pulse as well, which is something that's been, which has been talked about here and there. I just want to play a little bit of tape before we dive into that portion of what happened. It's from the mother of one of the victims. The mother's name is Mina Justice. And of course, as we heard, people from inside the club, as the shooting was going on, were sending texts to relatives. And here's what Mina says as one of the texts she received from her son.
He texted me at 2:06 and said, "Mommy, I love you." In the club, they're shooting, trapped in the bathroom, downtown. Please call police. I'm going to die.
It's so hard to hear even now. I can't imagine what it's like to receive a text message like that. But one, you know, as I was just saying a second ago, one of the things that came up is that meant for some of the family members of the victims, they were finding out for the first time, perhaps, that their family members were members of the LGBT community. Maybe they hadn't been out to their family members, and because there was this discussion about the Latino community and LGBT. And I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, I think it just adds to the horror of it. I think that there are so many aspects of this that are sort of an unexpected burden and unexpected tragedy for these families. One is, you know, who has money to bury your son who's 20 years old? You know, that's just a practical aspect. I would just say there's a GoFundMe effort going on that's collected $5 million for the victims of the shooting at the Pulse, and you know I think that's something that where the community has rallied around them, because there are, and I don't mean to get practical about this, but this is exactly what's happening. I mean, there are ramifications for these families mm-hmm. that go well beyond the fact that maybe they found out something about their children that they didn't know, but now they have to deal with something that is going to affect every aspect of their lives, including having lost a son or a daughter. And I think there are so many facets of this that are such a hardship for people that you don't necessarily think of, don't necessarily come to the surface right away.
I'd like to think that given everything that's happened this week and what happened in these families, that the fact that they might have just found out that their son or daughter was a member of the LGBT community is the least important thing. Mm. If you had a child who's lost, if you had a relative who is struggling to survive, and not to mention, as John mentioned, all the things that are going to be ahead of them. You know, even when the physical wounds heal, where are they going to be emotionally and mentally? So, you know, I'm sure that there were some instances where parents were just like, oh my God, my kid was there. But do you think that if a parent thought, well, I'd rather my kid be dead than be in a gay club? No, I think that they don't care. I really think that at the bottom line is that it doesn't matter to them.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a minute about the... So there's the issue of the LGBT community being targeted, and then there's also the questions now that some members of the Muslim community are fielding and asking themselves as well, because the gunman had reportedly said well before the shooting that the sight of two men kissing had disgusted him, and it's interesting because the gunman's father on Monday posted a video on Facebook in which he said God will punish those involved with homosexuality, but that it's, quote, not an issue that humans should deal with. He claimed to walk back his comments later that day on CBS News. But then again, on Tuesday, he spoke to reporters. This is the gunman's father, distancing himself from his son.
I'm sorry this happened. And in this country, you know, after age 18, the kids are on their own. You can do what you can, give them education, give them the manners, send them to college, and pay for the expenses. And once they graduate, they have their own life. As a father, you do so much. After that, you cannot do anything.
Renee, your thoughts?
You know, I think one thing I want people to be sort of careful with as we're going through this is this idea that somehow the Muslim community is so homophobic or the Latino community is so homophobic. We live in a homophobic society. It's homophobic in all of its corners and with all of its ethnicities and races. I think, you know, the idea that, oh, well, maybe his son was gay and that was, you know, his father wasn't approving and this is what happened as the result of that. I think it just becomes a really sort of dangerous narrative. You know, I don't think that's the most important thing here. I think the idea more is look at, like, why did this happen? The people who were trying to survive, what happens to these families? But this getting into this sort of thing of, well, he was Muslim and listened to the way his father talked about homosexuality. Maybe that pushed his son to do this. I'm not really following that. I'm not a fan of that way of thinking. Mm.
I think that there were so many signs about the shooter that that led people to believe that something terrible was going to happen around him. Ironically, he was a security guard until he turned out to be too racist and too violent to actually have the job. And I think that a lot of people now are coming out, including the FBI, and saying, this guy was trouble. This guy was a time bomb waiting to go off, and we knew this was going to happen, and what were we supposed to do about it? And it's a legitimate question, but, this is the result of something that a lot of people anticipated and expected to happen.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because the FBI did investigate the shooter, right, for a period of 10 months, but at that time, felt like there wasn't any sufficient evidence to continue the investigation and closed it. So, I mean, that, is the protocol for or the standard for which they continue to look into people wrong here?
Some people think the FBI is fighting the last war, that they're looking for homegrown terrorists to follow the sort of traditional path. You grow a beard, you pray more, you plan to travel abroad, you make connections with organized terrorist groups. It doesn't seem to be playing out that way anymore. It seems to have a whole different dynamic, part of which is social media and the fact that, you know, this shooter was there on Facebook while he's carrying out this massacre is something that is really sobering. It just makes you wonder, how corrosive social media can be. And I'm not condemning all social media, but I'm saying, you know, this is something that's happening in a different arena now. And there are some people who think the FBI just doesn't have a really good sense of how to control this. Just one more thing. People talk about, you know, why wasn't he being surveilled? The estimates are that the FBI could actively surveil maybe 50 people at a time. So, you know, there are far more of these kinds of potential terrorists out there who cannot be followed. It's just mathematically impossible. So,
it's hard to know.
Right, exactly.
You know, he was investigated, and now people can look at it and say, well, they should have done a lot more, and if you had him under surveillance, and why didn't you continue, and how did this happen? There might have been literally nothing more for them to go on. You know, he was living his life, he was married, he had a kid, he had his job. You know, what more could they have possibly have done? It's always easy, you know, to look at it now and say, well, something else should have been done, but I'm not sure anything else could have been done. Now, the argument could be made that perhaps the FBI needs to figure out another way of doing this. When someone comes up for some reason on their radar, whether it's what they're posting on social media or places they're frequenting, then maybe there's a way of doing that. But as John said, they only have so many resources, and there are a lot of people saying a lot of things on social media. It's impossible, really, to stop this kind of thing.
Right. So I'm seeing here that right now tens of thousands of counterterrorism tips come into the FBI each year, and not, of course, not all of them are legitimate, but that's still a huge volume to sort through. And law enforcement officials say that the FBI is investigating, and I don't know if it means actively surveilling, but investigating potentially 1,000 potential homegrown, quote, homegrown violent extremists. So there will be a great deal of discussion about, again, thresholds for action and not, and degrees of surveillance, which, you know, we'll keep looking at later. But the numbers are pretty staggering. But the one thing that the FBI question and then leads to is another question that people were asking a lot this week, which was, he was allowed to buy a gun. Granted, he was taken off the FBI's watch list, and then he legally purchased weapons. But of course, the gun control debate was, you know, revitalized this week. And I want to hear what the president had to say about that. Here he is on Tuesday speaking to the nation.
People with possible ties to terrorism who aren't allowed on a plane shouldn't be allowed to buy a gun. Enough talking about being tough on terrorism. Actually be tough on terrorism.
So there he is looking at Congress and saying, look, there are provisions that you could pass right now that would make it harder for people, certain people, to buy guns. It doesn't do any, he said it doesn't do anything to take away Second Amendment rights. But Renee, let me start with you about the gun control debate revived.
You know, if you can't stop the lone wolf who's going to go out there and do damage, at least you can change the weapons he's using. So if he goes in there with a revolver, he's not going to be able to kill 49 people. But if you go in there with essentially what is a weapon of war, which is what it was created to be, then yeah, he's going to create a, you know, he's going to kill a lot more people. So yes, you know, the idea that we're having the same conversation again, the conversation that was had after Aurora, the conversation that was had after Newtown, the conversation that was had after San Bernardino, and nothing gets done. I can't even comprehend how this many people can get killed over and over again, and all our leaders can offer our thoughts and prayers.
Well, so you know, we were looking at some numbers on gun violence in America. And in 2014, some 5,500 handguns were used for, you know, to kill people in the United States. And it was fewer than approximately 250 of this style of rifle were used. So, you know, I mean, I take the point that that these semi-automatic rifles are capable of doing vast damage, and they have been used in many of these mass shootings recently. But with all the focus on that, I mean, some people would say we're not actually really, you know, getting at the real problem, because there are these many, many more violent attacks that are happening with just handguns, John.
Right, and there are more guns in America than there are people in America. So I think that you've got a whole lot of different moving parts going on here. You know, this shooter passed the background test. And, you know, he went in and he was asking, according to one report, asking about body armor, that kind of thing. The gun store owner contacted the FBI. They didn't follow up, according to one report. So, you know, what you have is a series of sort of patchwork laws, some federal, some state, that have so many loopholes, that have so many trapdoors, that that it's virtually impossible to keep someone from getting these kinds of weapons now. There was an assault weapons ban from 1994 to 2004. It did seem to decrease these kinds of mass killings. I don't see that passing again. Massachusetts Congressman Bill Keating has just proposed a law where anybody who was on a terror list or had been under investigation by the FBI would not be able to buy a gun. That's going nowhere fast. I think that that there are forces at play here that are keeping the laws from being toughened and are keeping a number of the laws that are in effect from being very effective. And I think that that's something that's going to be very hard to untangle.
Mm. But, you know, it's a horror that while nothing gets done, we're supposed to somehow get used to large numbers of people being murdered in malls and churches and clubs and universities. I mean, I can't even figure out what Congress is doing anymore. You know, the idea that you had to have a 15-hour filibuster just to convince the GOP to even have a vote.
Right, from Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy.
Exactly. Right? It's like 15 hours just to kind of convince them to have the vote.
Which is a Potemkin vote because you know it's
anyway.
Never going
right.
to pass.
Yeah. And it's never going to pass.
Right. Yeah. So this
I'm not, I'm not blaming the Democrats in that necessarily. I think they did what they had to do. But the bottom line is that it's not going to achieve anything.
There's a lot of empty exercises going on here. And I think that one of the questions is, what is there that's that could potentially be effective that could be pursued?
OK, so speaking of empty exercises, I want to play a couple of pieces of tape about how this is all redounding in politics as well, because, you know, earlier this week, President Obama on Tuesday had that very sharply worded speech where he didn't say it by name, but he went after the presumptive GOP nominee, Donald Trump, because Trump has been criticizing Obama for not using the words radical Islam or Islamism. And the president said, well, that's all a political distraction. And then, of course, we also heard from both from Trump and Hillary Clinton this week. First of all, here's some tape from Hillary Clinton. She addressed this issue on Monday on NBC's Today Show.
To me, radical jihadism, radical Islamism, I think they mean the same thing. I'm happy to say either, but that's not the point.
And then Donald Trump responded on Wednesday at a rally in Atlanta.
And she said, I would use the term, but she didn't use it, but she didn't call it radical Islamic terrorism. She said radical Islamism.
So, I mean, what do you think? I mean, back to what President Obama said, do you think it's a political distraction?
It is a political distraction. I mean, time and again, you've had different politicians, usually on the right, saying, this isn't about guns, this is about terrorism. So it allows them to sort of, you know, continue that narrative of this is about terrorism, this is about Islam being bad, this is about Muslims being dangerous, and not really getting to the root of the problem, which is there are a lot of guns in this country. It can be both. It can be terrorism and guns. But the idea that you have to choose one or the other is sort of ridiculous. And the fact that they're choosing to talk about terrorism does become a distraction.
But this is a situation where whoever dictates the terms of the debate. And so if this is all about who's going to say radical Islamic terrorism, then it becomes a very different debate from who's going to do something about this and what are the effective ways we can go about addressing these kinds of problems. And that plays right into Donald Trump's hands. If this is about who's going to use particular vocabulary, that works to his advantage tremendously because it stays away from the substance of what needs to be done. Yeah. It stays away from any reality to what proposals you might raise, and it plays into the sort of dog whistle kind of politics that allows people to play on fear and anger and resentment and not really address what's a core problem in America at this point.
Yeah,
and you know, as long as you're playing the tomato tomato game, you're not talking about assault weapons. So you know, John's right. It works in Trump's favor because he's not talking about anything anyway. So when he's sort of like, well, he won't say it, it's not relevant, it's not important, and it's not getting to the root issues of what's going on.
Hmm. Well, you know, earlier this morning in our Radio Boston editorial meeting, we were wondering, because this is the time of the conversation that we usually turn to our hubbubs, and that's the lighter. You're shaking your head, John.
I don't think we do.
You don't think
today,
we do? So, because yeah. I was wondering about that, because I have to say, my argument this morning to the rest of the staff was, you know, maybe we need to just... We need to acknowledge how serious and intense and heartbreaking this week has been, which we have in this conversation, but also just remember that there are some maybe lighter things in life. I mean, if I'm going to take a little vote here, do you think it's good for hubbubs or no?
Well, I have a hubbub.
I do too, but it feels a little funny now.
Does it feel weird? Yeah. Okay.
My hubbub is really light, so it feels really
okay.
Hard to
I respect that. There's a little bit of Democratic action here. I'm seeing two votes.
This is very admirable.
Against hubbub. Well, that's fine. I mean, you know what? This has been an extraordinary, difficult week in the United States, and not doing hubbubs for once isn't going to harm anybody. And out of respect for everyone in Orlando who's suffered this week, it's right not to do it. So But I do want to say thank you to Renee Graham, op-ed contributor for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And John Carroll, professor of communications at Boston University and senior analyst for WBUR. Thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Good little democratic action here. I like it. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.